This is class number 8 in the Econ 111 Economics course. Please turn in your assignment for chapter 12 that is due today, as well as the extra credit work associated with the chapter if you chose to do the extra credit work. In the last class, and in this one as well, there are graphs that are discussed. It is important if you plan to take the AP Economics exam that you spend time studying the graphs until you come to an intuitive understanding of them. For example, we noted in the last class that the average revenue curve is the same as the demand curve, whether for a perfectly competitive firm or a monopolist firm. You need to understand why this is so. It is so because the price that the market consumers are willing to pay at a given output level, in other words, the demand price, is the same as the average price the firm will charge those customers at that output level, in other words, the average revenue. To take another example, we noted in the last class that the downward sloping average revenue curve is located above the marginal revenue curve. In other words, at any given output level, the marginal revenue price is below the average revenue price. This must be the case if the average revenue curve is downward sloping, because as such a downward slope implies that each additional unit of output is generating less revenue than the average revenue. If marginal revenue equaled average revenue, as it does for the perfectly competitive firm, then the average revenue curve would be flat and not downward sloping for the monopolist. But of course, the average revenue curve is downward sloping, and so we can deduce from that the marginal revenue curve must be below the average revenue curve. These two examples illustrate how you need to think about the graphs and come to understand why they are the way they are. Only in this way will you be able to do well on the AP exam. It will not work just to try to memorize things without understanding. Now let's move on to chapter 13. And let me read a little bit from, or at least read some of the highlights from the chapter. It begins this way. Businesses in America can take one of a variety of legal forms, with the following being among the more common: sole proprietorship, partnership, and corporation. A sole proprietorship is the simplest form of business organization to start and maintain. It is a business which legally has no separate existence from its owner. The owner receives the benefit of all the profits of the business. All debts of the business are debts of the owner. If the business were to get a judgment filed against it, it would be a problem for the owner. This form of business will have unlimited liability. Therefore, if the business is sued, it is the proprietor's problem. And it is a sole proprietorship in the sense that the owner has no partners. A partnership is a type of business entity in which the partners share with each other the profits or losses of the business undertaking in which they have all invested. In a partnership, the partners are held financially liable for the business transactions of the partnership. A corporation is a legal entity, distinct from a natural person, that often has similar rights in law to those of a natural person. As the term is generally used, a corporation is a commercial entity set up in accordance with a governmental framework, but various forms of non-commercial entities can also be corporations. The most salient features of incorporation include: 1. Limited liability. Unlike in a partnership or sole proprietorship, owners of a corporation, generally called shareholders, hold no liability for the corporation's debts and obligations. As a result, their limited potential losses cannot exceed the amount which they have contributed to the corporation as dues or paid for shares. 2. Perpetual lifetime. The assets and structure of the corporation exist beyond the lifetime of any of its owners or agents. This allows for stability and accumulation of capital, which thus becomes available for investment in projects of a larger size and over a longer term than if the corporate assets remain subject to dissolution and distribution. So that summarizes, in brief, the three major types of or legal forms of businesses in the U.S. Now, the chapter 13 gets into the issue of especially this characteristic of corporations known as limited liability. It examines the propriety of such a governmental, if you want to say, gift to corporations, giving their owners limited liability. And it raises the question whether owners should be given such limited liability. The chapter points out, several pages in, that Scripture teaches the principle that owners should be held fully accountable for what they own, as implied in such passages as Exodus 21, 28 through 36. It says this, "If an ox gore a man or a woman, that they die, then the ox shall be surely stoned, and his flesh shall not be eaten. But the owner of the ox shall be quit. But if the ox were wont to push with his horn in time past, and it hath been testified to his owner, and he hath not kept him in, but he hath killed a man or a woman, the ox shall be stoned, and his owner also shall be put to death. If there be laid on him a sum of money, then he shall give for the ransom of his life whatsoever is laid upon him, whether he have gored a son or have gored a daughter, according to this judgment it shall be done to him. If the ox shall push a manservant or maidservant, he shall give unto their master 30 shekels of silver, and the ox shall be stoned." And the passage goes on to note, as far as, again, and emphasize the responsibilities of the owners of the owner of the ox. According to these verses, moral propriety demands that the owner, in this case of an ox, but applicable to a whole host of cases besides, for example, see 1 Corinthians for how broadly case law should be applied, be held fully accountable for that which he owns. Hence, for example, if someone owns an ox that has a known history of being deadly, then the owner is responsible for making sure that the animal is kept penned in. But if the owner fails to do his duty, then that owner should be held personally accountable, even to the point of death. Principles of equity, thus, according to the Bible, demand that owners be so accountable for what they own. By releasing owners from this type of accountability via incorporation laws, the state is thwarting and circumventing biblical principles of equity. This is surely scripturally unwarranted. Owners should not be allowed a loophole out of the responsibility that biblical justice demands. This chapter goes on also to note that Scripture warns about partnership with the wicked, because God holds partner owners fully accountable. Scripture warns, "Be not unequally yoked with the ungodly." One major ill effect of entering into partnership with the wicked is that one thereby takes on the liability incurred by an irresponsible partner. This consequence serves as a retardant to entering into such partnership with the wicked. Hence, the wicked have a harder time creating larger businesses with multiple owners, and the godly are warned from entering into common ownership with them. But the corporate structure circumvents what would be the natural ill effects of partnership with the wicked. By conferring limited liability on the corporation, the corporate owner is not held fully responsible for the hiring of wicked managers or entering into partnership with wicked co-owners. This should not be allowed to occur. Now, As we have seen, chapter 13 has explored the question of whether it is right for a nation to create an entity like the corporation, where the owners of the entity are shielded from the responsibilities and liabilities biblically associated with ownership. It should be noted that this is different from the question of whether the individual should incorporate his business if he resides in a nation where such limitations on liability exist, and which tend to have problems with over-litigiousness and even frivolous and costly lawsuits, such as the U.S. tends to have. I personally believe incorporating in such a circumstance can be justified. But that does not mean the nation ideally should allow such over-litigiousness or that it should allow the creation of entities with such limited liability. As one reads chapter 13, one can see that limited liability corporations are largely a modern phenomenon. The question is whether owners should be let off the hook from responsibilities that ownership normally entails according to scriptural precept. Now, in chapter 14, it looks at production possibilities curve. The chapter is entitled, The You Cannot Have Your Cake and Eat It Too Principle. Limitation of resources and the outputs that they can produce can be graphically represented in what is called a production possibilities curve. A production possibilities curve represents outcome or production combinations that can be produced with a given amount of resources. For instance, let's say that a very small country currently availing itself of 100 acres of land, 20 machines, and 50 workers is able to produce maximally 500 machines and 350 units of consumer goods with these resources. However, it could also, with the same resources, produce 400 machines and 500 units of consumer goods. Or there are other alternatives. Under this scenario, we can see, and it is shown in this graph on the first page of chapter 14 in your textbook, the production possibilities curve under that scenario, where this nation, hypothetical nation, can decide between making totally just guns or just producing roses, or some combination of the two in between. Now, economics has generally taught, has this as a dictum: humans have unlimited wants but limited resources. This dictum is largely true, especially in a fallen world. And since it is true, humans have to choose how to allocate their limited resources, as discussed in this chapter 14. Of course, it is not wrong to want things within measure, but it is wrong to covet them. Chapter 14 goes on to make this point: if an economy is operating at a point on the production possibilities curve, it means by definition that all resources are used and they are utilized as efficiently as possible. It is, in other words, the maximum that can be produced with the existing resources and technology. It follows then that output cannot increase if resources and technology remain constant. When economists discuss the concept of scarcity, they refer to the economic reality that resources are limited and that at any given point in time, output is limited. The production of one particular good or a category of goods can increase, but only at the expense or opportunity cost of decreasing production of another good or category of goods. Opportunity cost is the cost of something in terms of an opportunity foregone, and the benefits that could be received from that opportunity are the most valuable foregone alternative. Over time, economic growth occurs when the economy realizes greater production capabilities to produce capital and consumer goods. For this to happen, resources like land, labor, or capital must increase, technology must improve, Morality must improve, or in other ways, God must materially bless the country. In a graph, economic growth can be illustrated by an outward shift of the production possibilities curve. And this chapter 14 concludes, such economic growth is typically a long-run phenomena, while a production possibility curve shows the currently available output options, assuming that God does not supernaturally intervene. In the short run, nations, like individuals, cannot have their cake and eat it too. It should be noticed that this chapter mentions opportunity cost, which is a term we previously discussed. While we are considering the production possibilities curve, I want us to consider some concepts that we shall be discussing more in future classes. These concepts are absolute advantage versus comparative advantage, and the concepts are illustrated in Exhibit 24. But let's first define the terms and some related terms. Absolute advantage is the ability of an economic actor, whether an individual, a household, or a firm, to produce some particular good or service with a smaller total input of economic resources, whether labor, capital, land, etc., per unit of output than other economic actors. Because one actor is more efficient in the production of the output, it is able to produce more. In the production possibility curves at Exhibit 24, suppose both nations, or it could be instead of a nation, if you want to think of it as an individual or a firm, but in this hypothetical example, it speaks of nations. Suppose both nations have an equal number of resources. Clearly, Nation 1 is more efficient than Nation 2. It therefore has an absolute advantage over Nation 2 in making both guns and roses. Comparative advantage is the ability of one economic actor, whether an individual, a household, a firm, a country, etc., to produce some particular good or service at a lower opportunity cost than other economic actors can. That is, the economic actor with the comparative advantage can produce the particular good or service by giving up less value in other goods or services than that he could otherwise produce with his labor and resources than the other economic actors would have to give up in producing that same good or service. In analyzing the theory of trade and economic specialization, it is important to distinguish then absolute from comparative advantage, since it is comparative advantage that determines the potential welfare gains from specialization in trade and not absolute advantage. This perhaps can be made clear by this example illustrated in Exhibit 24. Suppose both Nation 1 and Nation 2 are able to produce two goods, guns and roses. And you will see in your Exhibit 24 graph that those are the two choices on the production possibilities curve. For Nation 1, producing one gun requires 10 hours of labor, and producing one rose requires 20 hours of labor. For Nation 2, producing one gun requires 12 hours of labor, and producing one rose requires 48 hours of labor. Now, under this scenario, since every hour of labor devoted to making guns is an hour that cannot be used for making roses, and since there are only so many hours of working time available per month, both Nation 1 and Nation 2 face trade-offs in allocating their working time between the two possible activities. Making more guns means making fewer roses and vice versa. But the precise numerical trade-offs the two face are different. For Nation 1, in this Exhibit 24, every additional rose he produces only cost him two guns he could otherwise have made in the 20 hours. But for Nation 2, every additional rose he produces cost him four guns he could otherwise have made in the 48 hours of labor. Because Nation 1 only has to give up two guns per rose, While nation 2 has to give up 4 guns per rose, nation 1 is said to have a comparative advantage in rose making. And by the same token, nation 2 has a comparative advantage in gun making, since it only gives up 1/4 of a rose for every gun it makes, whereas nation 1 gives up 1/2 of a rose for each gun it makes. Note that an economic actor can display a comparative advantage in the production of a particular good, even when the other actor happens to have an absolute advantage in producing the same good. And we, of course, saw that in this Exhibit 24 example. In this particular example, Nation 1 is evidently much more efficient in making both products than Nation 2 is. Thus, Nation 1 has an absolute advantage in making both products. But Nation 2, nevertheless, still has a comparative advantage in gun making. This is because any actor's comparative advantage depends only upon the relationship between that single actor's own levels of productivity for two goods under consideration, while absolute advantage depends only upon the relationship between two actors' levels of productivity for the same single good under consideration. The distinction between comparative and absolute advantage is important because it is comparative advantage and not absolute advantage that determines the amount of the potential gains in output from specialization and trade between the two actors. And this leads us to the principle of specialization. According to comparative advantage, total production of goods will be increased if each economic actor devotes more of his scarce resources to producing the goods in which he has a comparative advantage and less of his scarce resources to producing the goods in which he has a comparative disadvantage. If the two actors can agree to trade goods at any exchange ratio or price that is somewhere between the different opportunity cost ratios of the two actors, then both actors will be able to have more of both goods and therefore be better off with specialization than would be possible without specialization, even if one actor has an absolute advantage over the other in production of both goods. So two terms associated with the concept of comparative advantage are specialization and division of labor. Specialization, in the economic sense, is the social phenomena of individual human beings or organizations each concentrating their productive efforts on a rather limited range of tasks. Specialization entails focusing on a narrow area of knowledge or skill or activity. It involves a person or an organization's adapting for the unusually effective or efficient performance of some particular function, often at the expense of the individual organization's ability to perform most other functions for themselves, which are then necessarily left to others with more appropriate skills or talents or abilities. Like the division of labor, specialization generally comes about because it is discovered, usually by trial and error, that the individuals or groups concerned can increase their productivity and hence under a market economy their incomes through greater specialization according to the principle of comparative advantage. Division of labor is the division of a complex production process into a number of simpler tasks, each one of which is undertaken by a different individual who typically, but not necessarily, specializes in one task or a very few tasks on a more or less permanent basis. The advantages of division of labor for enhancing human productivity were extensively analyzed by Adam Smith in his 1776 book, The Wealth of Nations, where he coined the phrase. We shall be considering more about Adam Smith later in this course. We should note that division of labor is not simply a modern phenomenon. Even the opening chapters of Genesis, we read how Abel specialized in one trade and Cain in another. Or consider how the Levites were dedicated to the temple service, while other Israelite tribes did other work. We find that some people specialized in fishing, some specialized in carpentry, etc. Having said all this, there can be reasons why a nation might wisely retain some level of production in industries, even where it lacks comparative advantage. For example, if a nation had no internal defense industry, then it could find itself at the mercy of foreign nations in a war, and it could be in big trouble if those foreign nations are enemy states. One thing we should keep in mind is that while Scripture warns against entering into partnership or co-ownership with non-Christians, it does not forbid trade with non-Christians. We see in many places in Scripture where the people of God trade goods with the heathen, and this is regarded as acceptable conduct. Well, that concludes the material we needed to cover in class number 8. Remember, the assignments for chapters 13 and 14 are due by the class 1 week from now.